The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
We have a chapter on reforming war powers and the president's control over nuclear weapons. This is a perennial issue. It's one on which Congress has not wanted to exercise responsibility for a long time. It's one that we think should be reformed. We have lots of proposals, both with regard to traditional war powers and the president's control over nuclear weapons. But that is an area where Congress is probably not easily going to accept more responsibility and where the president will fight like the devil not to give it up.
I'm Benjamin Wittes, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, September 18th, 2020. After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency is a new book published by Lawfare itself. Its authors are Bob Bauer, former White House counsel in the Obama White House, and Jack Goldsmith, Lawfare co-founder and, of course, former OLC chief in the Bush administration. The book is a look across a range of areas at the manner in which Donald Trump has disrupted the presidency and a series of proposals for reforms to try to restore norms that his presidency has disrupted. Bob Bauer and Jack Goldsmith both joined me in the Jungle Studio to discuss the book, how they came to write it, and the specific proposals they put on the table. We talked about ethics. We talked about disclosure. We talked about the relationship between the Justice Department and the White House. And we talked about what the problems are that can and can't be solved through reform. It's the Lawfare Podcast, September 18th. Goldsmith and Bauer on After Trump. I want to start with the motivating spirit of the book rather than the details of the book. This book comes out in the midst of a fiercely contested presidential election that the president might win. The title of it might imply to a certain group of people a kind of belief that we're talking about a reform project that begins imminently. Bob, get us started. Why did you guys write this book, and to whom is it directed, and when?
We started writing another book, actually. We were talking about other more narrowly cast institutional reform questions. For example, though we do treat it in a separate chapter, we were actually considering writing at length about the White House counsel's office. And the more we talked about it, the more we came to the conclusion that if we were going to undertake this kind of institutional reform analysis, we would want to cover the broadest possible range of topics in light of all of the questions that have now acquired some urgency in the wake of Donald Trump's presidency. We also decided we would write a book that we hoped would be of general interest, but to write it with some considerable detail and in a legally nuanced way. And the audience, we hoped, would be those who want to enter into and are interested in a serious debate about a reform of the presidency, which we think is long overdue.
And how do you understand when you say the audience is it's written for a general interest reader, but with some specificity? I mean, the level of specificity goes down to the level of a series of appendices that include proposed legislative language. You know, who is the book for, really?
We would hope that anybody who's interested in this reform debate can find in the book the part that is of most interest to them, at the level at which they would like to entertain these reform proposals and the historical and legal analysis behind them. We clearly hope, and we've had already some opportunity for conversations with those on Capitol Hill who are interested in this topic, certainly those in the press, in the policy-making, policy analysis community, in the academy. So just, I hope, across a broad range of interests of readers who are interested in this question of how we should reform the presidency in light of what we've learned about the clear weaknesses that have been, in many cases, exploited by Trump and by a future president could be exploited even more dangerously.
Jack, one of the things that's interesting about this book is that it's, to some degree anyway, across a bit of an ideological, I wouldn't say chasm, but gap. You come out of the conservative world. Bob's a longtime Democratic lawyer. To what extent was this self-consciously a bipartisan, nonpartisan project, and that you were trying to bridge political differences, or was this just, you know, two guys with senior executive branch level experience who decided to take on these issues together?
It was more of the former, Ben. We, as Bob said, we started out to write a book about the White House counsel, and at that point, the fact that we came from at that time different parties, or that I was conservative and Bob wasn't, didn't seem to matter. We were just focusing on one institution. I can't speak for Bob on this, but for me, when we decided to write this broader book, I guess Bob agreed with me on this. We actually were sort of self-conscious of the fact that we had different views on probably on politics. And we may have had different views on executive power issues. We really weren't sure, but we kind of committed to work them out. We had just discussion after discussion, email exchange after email exchange, about whether this works, whether that works, whether this goes too far, whether that goes too far. We adopted a principle up front in the book that we called the golden rule, which basically is that these reforms should be reforms acceptable to either party, and that someone from one party should consider in thinking about these rules what it's like to be in the presidency and outside of the presidency. And I think at the end of the day, I think we hoped that if people of different political outlooks could agree on the basic structure of reform, then there might be some attraction to that fact. The fact that we're coming from different perspectives, but we're able to sort of reach some insights and some conclusions that we were both quite comfortable with.
So right now, though, the idea that we are facing the premise of the book, which is that Donald Trump has exposed the need for reform in aspects of the presidency across a range of issues, is one that Democrats and liberals are generally speaking much more friendly to than Republicans, for the simple reason that to accept that premise is to accept that there is something exceptional about the Trump presidency. Do you find that the working premise here is one that is easier to sell to liberals than to conservatives, or is there a pretty wide or even acceptance or skepticism between the political movements?
So, right now, today, there is very little interest in these reforms among Republicans, elected Republicans, because Trump is president and he so dominates his party. But we think that once Trump has left the scene, whether that's in 2021 or 2025, but more assuredly, that I think this is true if he leaves in 2021, that on many of these reforms, and of course there are a lot of reforms and some of them have different political valences, but on many of these reforms, they should, in theory, be attractive to Republicans. This kind of rule, the conflict of interest reforms, there's no particular reason to think that Republicans would be in favor of having a Democrat president exploit conflict of interest rules and not disclose taxes and mingle public and private interests in the presidency. So not only will we think Republicans look at these issues differently once they no longer have control of the White House, but also on many of these issues, I wouldn't call them traditional Republican positions that we have landed on. But I do think that there should be a lot of interest in bucking up executive accountability once the Republicans have the shoe on the other foot, so to speak.
All right. So, Bob, walk us through the structure of the book and give us a little, I mean, not quite a chapter outline, but a thematic outline of the material you cover.
The structure of the book, I would sort of, I think, summarize as follows. We open with a discussion about reform initiatives, some of the potentials, some of the perils, some of the difficulties of reform initiatives generally, with some attention to the experience most recently in this country with a presidency-focused reform initiative, namely post-Watergate, the Watergate era of reform. And we sort of try to lay out a realistic framework for thinking about this sort of a reform program. And then the book, in three parts, takes up very specific topics, and each chapter is divided into three parts: an historical background that discusses the issue as it developed up to the presidency of Donald Trump, then a section that addresses the Trump presidency, what is or is not unique about the way in which he managed those same issues or the way in which he exposed the seriousness of those issues through his conduct, through his speech, and a combination of both. And then a third section, which addresses reform, that takes the particular issues we've addressed, the problems that we've identified, and in some detail proposes reform. And I think, as you indicated in one of your questions, we have appendices with a summary of the reform proposals. And in a few cases, we cast them into what we would consider to be sort of model statutory or regulatory language. And I'll simply close by saying, the first part is entitled The President. The second part is addressed to President's Justice Department Relations. And the third part, President and the Congress.
All right. So I want to go through some of those specifically, but I want to do it in a not necessarily the same order that you do it in the book, which is you organize it by subject. I want to talk about it in ascending order of difficulty. That is, start with the stuff that's easiest to reform, where there are the fewest constitutional barriers and maybe the broadest expected range of political acceptance, and go from there to the areas that are going to be most difficult to reform, either because people believe in the system as we have or because the Constitution guarantees certain aspects of it have to look somewhat like the way they do. So I want to ask you both, what's the low-hanging fruit here? So let's say a new Congress comes in with a new administration that is inclined to undertake a reform project, either in the coming 6 months or 3 months or, you know, a year, 4 years after that. What's the stuff that they could do really easily that would make, you know, within its sphere a big difference without constitutional controversy and without asking you to do the political analysis, without major controversy at the policy level?
Most of the low-hanging fruit, I think, as you call it, and it's not all of them are without difficulty, but even within that low-hanging fruit category, they're the ones that seem like most accessible and politically saleable, and others that are going to be more complicated, either in concept or in execution. But those are found, I think, in part one. And they include, for example, and maybe this is the lowest of the low-hanging fruit, addressing Donald Trump's refusal to follow the norm of personal tax disclosure as a candidate and as a president. We devote a chapter to that, and I think it's important to say why, because we do think the details matter. So we lay out the history, then we lay out the Trump story on his refusal to release his tax returns, and then we take up what a requirement for disclosure, statutory requirement for disclosure might look like, how it would be designed and how it would be enforced. But I do think that once the argument about tax returns is not an argument that, say, Donald Trump supporters or the Republican Party will interpret simply as an argument about Trump and an attack on Trump, once it's on the table as something presidents since Jimmy Carter have, with the exception of Donald Trump, uniformly done, I think that argument is an argument relatively easily won on the politics. And I don't think the design, although not inconsequential, of the reform is all that difficult. When you move to another piece of this, which is related, financial conflicts of interest, Donald Trump running a business concurrently with acting as president, holding the office, the way in which he set up his trust, that his sons run, that it obviously has been a focus of his attention. And clearly, there are more than a few indications that he's promoted his business and certainly operated in such a way that he could make money off his business. It certainly raises the question of gaps in the financial conflicts of interest realm, in the regulation of conflict of interest among presidents. And there again, we take up the history, we discuss what has been unique about Trump, and then we go to the details. Those details are more complicated than the ones in tax disclosure, but there are details we think that we can work out, that can be worked out on a bipartisan basis, and we suggest directions it could take. I'll stop there for a moment, but I think those are two that I would identify in part one that I think are politically most easily sellable, if you will, and I think we can offer some, and have offered, some avenues to design that ought to be broadly acceptable.
It also seems to me, Jack, that some of the reforms that you contemplate to the obstruction of justice statute is relatively low-hanging fruit, which is not to say that there wouldn't be some conceivable applications of that, the statute that you propose, that would have as applied constitutional questions, but I think as a general matter, it would clearly encumber presidential obstructive behavior more than the current statute does. So walk us through what your reforms to the obstruction statute look like, how they work, and why you think they would make a difference over the status quo.
Sure, Ben. So let me just give a little background on that first. There was a lot of debate during the Mueller investigation, and indeed in the Mueller report, about, there was discussion of this, about the extent to which the current obstruction of justice statutes even apply to the president. And there's a debate about that, about the extent to which there needs to be a plain statement rule and the extent to which that plainly applied them to the president, and the extent to which, if that happened, it would be a constitutional to hold the president to an obstruction of justice standard, especially in areas that relate to his Article II duties. So one of the things that we propose is that Congress clarify in a narrow and targeted way that the obstruction of justice statute does, in fact, apply to the president and the vice president. And the narrow and targeted way that we do that is to focus on the president trying to obstruct justice in cases involving himself or his family, and in cases involving elections. And then we have an obstruction of justice-like reform with regard to the pardon power, to ensure that the president doesn't, in effect, offer a pardon to someone in exchange for obstructing justice. And so those are the main areas that we propose that the statute be reformed. And that some people think the statute, even without naming the president specifically, applies to the president. We think that it's an intolerable state of affairs that neither the president nor the Congress nor the nation knows about the extent to which that is true. And we think Congress should focus on those narrowly targeted reforms as the ones that, because they're narrowly targeted and because of their nature, may be more likely to pass constitutional scrutiny and that get at the more serious problems.
In other words, you, Jack, were one of the people who was arguing that absent a plain statement in the statute, these, at least the traditional executive branch position, is that a criminal statute, can't apply to the president or doesn't apply to the president. And so what you're basically saying is Congress should close the loophole that I argued was arguably there under current law. Is that a fair summary?
That's certainly one way of putting it, but it's not a question of whether it's, you know, my position or whether I'm right on this. There, no one denies that there's an uncertainty on this question, and there's two levels of uncertainty. Does the statute even apply to the president? And if it applies to the president, which applications are constitutional, if any? And we could continue along as we have thus far, having these debates in the abstract and trying to predict what the Supreme Court would say about this if it ever got to the court. We think the executive branch needs more concrete guidance. We think the president should want more concrete guidance. And we also think that this more concrete guidance, in addition to taking away these plain statement concerns, would really tee up the constitutional question and focus it. So, you know, you've asked the question about which reforms are hard and which are easy. And you focused on which the difficulty of passing them in Congress. And there we can talk maybe later about some of the ones that are really, really hard. But I just wanted to emphasize that approximately half of the reforms in the book are ones that the president alone or the attorney general alone, i.e. the executive branch, can implement and that we urge it to implement. And there are a range of these issues, ranging from how presidents should be investigated, how presidential campaigns should be investigated, to restructuring the special counsel's office and the like. And I mention these because it's important to understand that reform doesn't just take place in Congress. The president and the executive branch can unilaterally make many of these reforms. These reforms, if done right, we hope can spark norms that were fairly consequential even during the Trump administration, and that, and in a sense, like the 1970s, we hope that these reforms can buck up norms even more. So I just emphasize this because it really raises the stakes for the next president's attitude towards these issues, because some of them many of them are going to be constraining of the presidency. How much does the next president want to constrain him or herself in the face of these norms in a way that Carter and Ford did in the 70s? How much does the attorney general want to do this? And so the identity of those two people, the president and the attorney general, are going to be absolutely vital to the success of many of our reforms.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's so tempting in any administration to say, hey, the statutes give us too much authority here, but we are wise, good people who won't abuse it. And so you kind of defend the prerogative on the theory that the next people will be as wise and good as you believe yourself to be. And the result is that nobody ever has the incentive for reform. And it's a hard habit for wise executive branches to unlearn, that the threat of not having the authority might be less than the threat of your successor, or even if you're really unself-aware yourself, using the authority. So let's talk about those areas that are really low-hanging fruit, you know, the ones that an executive inclined to tie him or herself to the mast can do so of the executive's own accord. What's the stuff that is, you know, really at the executive's discretion here, and how would that help?
We cite a host of possibilities, but within the Department of Justice, for example, there are standards that the department could restore to the forefront, could incorporate into the Supplemental Ethics Code, into its own regulations, that would have a very meaningful effect on overall departmental awareness of what's necessary to avoid politicization of the law enforcement process. And those are, by the way, in part based on legal positions that the department has taken in the past that could then be converted into binding guidance through the various manuals that the department uses to educate those who are responsible for law enforcement prosecutions, deliberation about whether to proceed with prosecutions and prosecutions. For example, the Obama administration took a particular position in the U.S. attorney firings controversy about the application of federal law to actions that might be taken within a department to, say, accelerate charging decisions or take other actions that could have an effect on an election. It seems to me those could be, it seems to Jack and me that those can be addressed through the department essentially binding itself to standards previously articulated. That's one example. There's another example I'll draw from something maybe it would be viewed as sort of fanciful to discuss in some respects, but I think not. And that is in the chapter in which we discuss the White House relationship to the press. Obviously, presidents have a huge amount of control over their own space. They can hold or not hold White House press briefings if they wish. As we know from the Trump administration experience, they can, if they follow their own regulations, decide to drum a reporter out of the White House press briefing space on, you know, some alleged ground of behaving poorly or not abiding by rules of decorum. The Trump administration, of course, has waged an all-out attack on the press. We discussed in our historical section sort of some precedent for that, for example, in the Nixon administration's behavior toward the press. But we think that regulations for the allocation of press passes could be, in fact, revised to basically hold an administration to a standard of fair dealing with the press, where political differences are, in fact, not what's motivating in discriminatory treatment of reporters for the purpose of the White House controlling more tightly its own narrative. There are also in that chapter, by the way, at least one statutory reform suggestion that we make, but that's an example of an internal regulation that would both give everybody more guidance and also commit the administration to fair dealing with the press. So those are two examples that I would cite, and there are others in the book on other topics.
All right, so let's talk about some of the really hard issues. There are some issues here where we just, you know, run into the fundamental nature of the presidency. For example, the pardon power, for example, the ability to fire people. And there's really kind of almost only so much that Congress can do. Jack, how do you understand? I mean, these are areas where you guys propose stuff, but you're pretty candid that there's that you're kind of working around the edges because core presidential powers are involved. So what are the issues where the presidency is least amenable to reform?
Well, I'll discuss the two that you just mentioned, Ben, and then mention the third. So the pardon power has been described as one of the broadest powers of the presidency. And it is indeed a broad power. And Donald Trump has showed how it can be used in a highly politicized way to serve the president's political interests. And there's not a lot that can be done absent a constitutional amendment to affect a lot of that. But we do point out in our pardon chapter that there are some things Congress can do to tighten up the norms around the pardon power and to, in fact, constrain the exercise of the pardon power. And I'll just mention two quickly. One, just because the president can pardon someone and has near absolute power to pardon someone doesn't mean necessarily that the president could do so as part of a bribe or in order to obstruct justice, because that, of course, is a separate a crime. And we think that Congress could, in fact, define the bribery statute in a way to criminalize the president who sought to offer a pardon in exchange for some sort of a bribe or including obstruction of justice of a proceeding. We also think that Congress can help the constitutional question of whether a president can self-pardon by actually making clear that Congress's constitutional view that the president cannot self-pardon. So there are areas in which we think that the pardon power can and should be reformed. Second, you mentioned the president's removal power. It's a very broad power. It's getting broader all the time in the Supreme Court. And so, for example, there was a lot of concern about the way that Trump fired inspectors general, the internal watchdogs who were supposed to in each agency. And Trump fired a lot of them. And one proposal on the Hill and elsewhere to deal with the problem of Trump exercising his undoubted Article II power to fire was to place for cause limitations on his ability to fire, i.e. to limit to the circumstances in which the president can in fact fire inspectors general. And we just think that that might work, but it's really running into some hard Article II problems. So we, in that case, especially with inspectors general, propose a different kind of fix that we think addresses the problem, and that is coming at it from the vacancies angle. And without getting too much into the details, if a president has plenary discretion to fire an inspector general, he doesn't have plenary discretion on how to replace that inspector general. Congress has a lot more authority on that end of things, at least on a temporary basis until there's a Senate confirmed someone for the position. And so we have some vacancy reform exceptions that would create significant disincentives for the president to terminate inspectors general because they're going to have a hard time getting a crony in there on the back end. So that's an example where we try to deal with the Article II roadblock through the side, so to speak. And I'll just briefly mention one more, probably one of the hardest issues in the book. We have a chapter on reforming war powers and the president's control over nuclear weapons. This is a perennial issue. It's one on which Congress has not wanted to exercise responsibility for a long time. It's one that we think should be reformed. We have lots of proposals, both with regard to traditional war powers and the president's control over nuclear weapons. But that is an area where Congress is probably not easily going to accept more responsibility and where the president will fight like the devil not to give it up.
One of the areas where I think Trump has really revealed the most latent unused power relates not to the actual core powers of the presidency, but to delegated powers from Congress, particularly but not exclusively in the emergency context. And, you know, you have these statutes that just sit there with these giant sweeping grants of power from Congress to the president, including, you know, immigration statutes, which are really areas of immense congressional power. But Congress has kind of turned them into areas of executive power with these delegations. And all of it works pretty well across both parties. And then you have Trump, where all of a sudden people look at the situation and say, oh my God, like what kind of a monster has Congress created and the president? And so you have some specific proposals in the area of emergency powers. I'm interested, walk us through that, but also I'm interested for both of your thoughts just on the question of, should Congress be taking a systematic look at areas where it has given these very broad grants of power to the executive to kind of make policy in a diverse range of areas, mostly involving foreign affairs, but not exclusively?
Yeah, so I'll answer the second question first and then talk about emergencies. I'll answer the second question in general terms. You're absolutely right that Congress has increasingly over the 20th century mostly, because it hasn't done much in the 21st century, through delegation, just given away so much legislative power to the president. The two you mentioned are two great examples, the immigration context, emergency powers, which I'll get to in a second. And in so many areas, basically, the president has nearly unfettered discretion to set policy in a whole range of issues. And there's actually bipartisan agreement that this is a problem, not always on the same issue. But dealing with that issue is a huge, huge structural problem. I mean, it is a problem about how to figure out how to really alter separation of powers as they've been practiced for the last few decades, how to organize Congress so that it wants to accept more responsibility and exercise its traditional prerogatives. Yes, we do believe that this whole range of issues should be examined, but we don't, you know, we could have written five books about the excessive delegations from Congress to the president. We do have some reforms on emergency powers. Actually, the emergency powers that Trump is most notorious for on the border wall and on the Insurrection Act that he didn't really exercise were ones that, you know, really weren't as consequential as people worried. But whereas where he's been most consequential in emergency powers is basically upending U.S.-China trade policy and economic interaction with China. I mean, all of the Huawei and the TikTok stuff and most of the stuff he's done on the economic front has been done through the International Emergency Economic Powers Act, which is an enormously broad delegation to the president that gives the president just hugely broad discretion to change economic policy on a dime. We don't take that on fully. We basically focus on the Insurrection Act, which is the act that allows the president to use the military in the homeland when there's threats or disturbances or insurrections that make it impossible to enforce federal law. Many people were worried, both inside the government and out, that Trump was going to exercise this extraordinarily broad power. He didn't in the end, really. But the fact that he was considering it and that he could so easily use it really got people to focus on this. And again, to make a long story short, we basically suggest tightening up the definitions in the act for when the president's power is triggered. We propose a mandatory consultation between the president and the state, the governors, on the appropriateness of exercising this power. And most importantly, we basically put a sunset provision, a very short sunset provision, on the exercise of these powers, 30 days, and require the president to go back to Congress to get additional authority after that. There's no reason that the president should need to exercise that authority for more than a month without being able to go back to Congress. And I'll just say one final thing. The whole problem of emergency powers generally, it worked better before the case called INS versus Chadha. And that was the case that declared the legislative veto unconstitutional. A lot of the emergency powers that Congress has given the president, not the Insurrection Act, but a lot of the others like IEPA, originally assumed that Congress would be able to disagree with the president and stop the exercise of emergency power if it disagreed through a one-house or two-house veto. And when the Supreme Court declared that unconstitutional about 40 years ago, it really dramatically changed the statutes and left the president with massively more power. Congress needs to go back and rethink how it can recreate something like the legislative veto.
And also how, I mean, to what extent it can apply the model that you guys have described in, you know, sunsetting emergency authority and requiring that those emergency authorities be affirmatively ratified by Congress rather than overturned by Congress after a certain period of days. How many statutes that model could be applied to? My suspicion is it's actually quite a lot.
I agree that with that. But I also want to just a note of reality here, much easier said than done, because that requires Congress to actually take the responsibility for engaging on the issue.
Yes, which brings us back to the point that I started with. These are the issues that are both constitutionally difficult and issues that are actually politically difficult, in this case, not for partisan reasons, but for congressional accountability reasons. Okay, I want to ask about one more substantive area and then wrap up with a broader forward-looking question. The major substantive area is what constitutes a lot of the second section of the book, which is the relations between the White House and the Justice Department. In broad strokes, how do you propose to change that relationship, and what parts of it really are changeable?
Ben, this is one of the, again, another hugely difficult issue, and we talk about it over five chapters, and we don't have a silver bullet. We have about 15 different reforms. We basically think that the norms from the 70s of independence worked pretty well until Trump. And they actually worked better than people appreciate, even during the Trump administration, in terms of, at least until Barr became Attorney General, the Department of Justice maintaining its independence. But basically, our reforms include bucking up the authority of the special counsel to be able to find facts in the face of a president or an attorney general who wants to stop it from doing so. We also think, and this is something we haven't talked about, this is not so much about Trump as it is about the FBI and the Justice Department. We think it's very important, and this is an important element of DOJ White House relations, that the FBI and the DOJ develop much better rules about when a president or a presidential campaign can be investigated and why, and have much more clarity on the chain of command and on responsibility for those issues. Part of our reforms we've already discussed are the obstruction of justice idea, so that the president has a clearer sense, and we hope, to deter of when actions he would take would obstruct justice. And another reform that Bob mentions, and then I'll stop here because they're a whole host, and we think that the aggregate reform is really what's important here, about kind of making clearer the accepted norms that have been accepted by the department and articulated by the department about non-politicized prosecutions, but making those norms much clearer and much more pervasive within the department. There are other reforms, but those are just some of them.
One of the ones, Bob, that touches you close to your professional heart is a really interesting proposal about the White House Counsel's Office. Tell us about that.
Certainly. If you don't mind, I'll add one more word as we wind down about the special counsel rules, because I think that, of course, is also relevant here. The White House Counsel's Office, of course, has been a controversial office from the beginning, and certainly been controversial in the Trump administration, but also administrations before it. There have been some sharp critiques, I think some of them very overdrawn. There's no question that the president should have available to him or her in the West Wing legal advisors at hand to address many of the day-to-day questions that do come up, and also to assist with congressional oversight and, if scandal were to break out, scandal management. But we concluded, and I was surprised to have myself concluded, since it's the best job I've ever had, that the White House Counsel's Office needs reform. That is to say that we think more of the legal advisory function that the president depends upon ought to be shifted from the White House to the Department of Justice. Until the Roosevelt administration, that's how it worked anyway. We wouldn't get rid of a White House counsel. We'd have a White House counsel with, you know, a handful of deputies to make it possible for him or her to function. But we think the core work of legal analysis and advice, just the raw legal work on which I think the White House counsel ought to depend in advising the president, ought to come from the Department of Justice. We think that's a culture shift and a norm shift that would be significant. The White House is a highly politicized, if you will, hothouse environment, and it's not always the best place for lawyers across the board to function, but it's indispensable that they do. However, to have a White House counsel's office that is small and a Department of Justice that plays a much larger role in legal advice for the president, it seems to us, it would be a very healthy development very quickly, because I think it relates to these questions you're asking about, you know, sort of DOJ independence. We have an entire chapter on the special counsel, and we try to develop an approach here that we would encourage a future administration to adopt, that is much clearer about the lines of authority between the White House, the special counsel when appointed, and the attorney general, and in particular protects what we think is critical, which is the special counsel's fact-finding function. Because at the end of the day, of course, the attorney general does make, and indeed the president, if it comes to that, does make the final decisions on questions of prosecution. But obviously, in the special counsel context, it's assumed the president wouldn't, but because it would involve his or her own legal affairs. But the attorney general does have that final authority. But we think the special counsel's fact-finding authority needs to be protected. We lay that out in some detail. It's one of the model texts we have in the appendices. And here is also my last point, where I think Congress also everywhere, this is a book about the executive branch, not about the Congress, but we elevate and emphasize Congress's potential role in these reforms wherever we can. And here Congress does have roles, roles to, for example, assure that the statute of limitations is told for presidents under investigation in office so that the president can't run out the clock on a prosecution, that the Congress has is informed by the special counsel on a fully protected basis about the fact findings of investigations, that the Congress also codify the grounds for removal of a special counsel to provide more protection, as it threatened at some point to do but didn't do in the Mueller case. It turned out it wasn't required to do it because Mueller finished his work. And so that is a place where we put a huge amount of effort into developing the reform, allocating lines of responsibility, showing how it might be done, and making sure it was clear what Congress's role was.
I want to ask one more question, which is admittedly completely hypothetical. But imagine that Donald Trump loses 2 months from now. Joe Biden comes in and they take this book and they say, this is our reform agenda. We are going to implement every single example of this, every single proposal in the book. And they do that. And then Donald Trump runs against Biden in 2024 and beats him. And so we have a second Trump term subject to the rules and proposals that you have made in response to the first Trump term. How much more constrained is Donald Trump than he was this time around?
Yeah, I would say significantly more constrained. I think once we have some of these statutory reforms in place, well, there are statutory reforms in place. It's the law. Some of these gaps have been filled. If we have an opportunity to see some of this internal regulation together with the statutory reforms, reinvigorate norms, you know, there are some pressures here that will have some effect. It may be not so much on what Trump is inclined to do in the nightmare scenario where he reappears at some point in the future, but rather on the people who are there, you know, thinking about their own exposure and what they're prepared to do or not prepared to do, you know, keeping in mind the number of people who just refuse to follow his repeated efforts to get Mueller fired. You know, is it a problem if you have a reform program and it's followed by, you know, a Donald Trump who doesn't care for the entire kit and caboodle? Of course it is. But you have to accomplish what you can, and I think one could accomplish a significant amount.
Jack, close us out.
I agree with what Bob said. I just want to emphasize that it's not all or nothing, and it doesn't have to all happen at once. If Joe Biden is president in 2021, a lot of these reforms can be implemented, but it really is going to depend on really leadership from the top in the executive branch, how much they want to make this an issue, how much that they're going to go along with Congress imposing constraints, and how much the president and the attorney general are willing, like presidents in the 70s, on the following a norm-breaking president, how much they are willing to take political heat and to restrain themselves in an effort to put back in place some of the institutional norms that have been so important in the last 40 years.
We are going to leave it there. The book is After Trump, Reconstructing the Presidency. The authors are Bob Bauer and Jack Goldsmith. The publisher is, of all things, Lawfare. Thank you both so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Thank you, Ben.
The Lawfare podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our audio engineer this episode was Zachary Frank of Goat Rodeo. The Lawfare podcast is produced and edited by Jen Patya Howell. It is promoted by the PR firm of you, the listener, who should promote the Lawfare podcast by rating and reviewing us in whatever podcast service you found us in, by tweeting about us, sharing us on Facebook and all the social media companies you use, by buying merch so that you wear the Lawfare podcast wherever you go. You can do that at thelawfarestore.com. Our music is, as ever, performed by Sophia Yan. And as always, thanks for listening.
Want flexibility? Take yoga. Want flexibility with your health insurance? Check out United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly medical, dental, and vision coverage that may be right for you. More at uh1.com.